Good morning. Today's daf in Bava Basra is Kuf Nun Zayin. We are starting today on Kuf Nun Vav Amud Beis. We have a little bit more to do before we start the second Mishnah, or the bottom Mishnah, I should say. We are finishing up the sugya from yesterday. The Mishnah brought in an opposing viewpoint. The Mishnah on the bottom of Kuf Nun Vav Amud Aleph brought in an opposing viewpoint who simply does not subscribe to this whole institution of Matnas Chemira. Meaning now for the last 10 blad of Gemara, since Kuf Mem Vav. Yeah. Since Kuf Mem Vav Amud Beis, the Gemara taught us about the institution of Matnas Chemira, which means that if a person is dying and he is really concerned that he doesn't know when exactly he's going to die, but he knows it's imminent, so there's a special institution that's afforded this individual that he can assign his assets to people even without making a formal kinyan. And this is done basically to create some sort of comfort for the individual, knowing that all of his instructions are going to be followed even though there's no kinyan. And this is a principle of Matnas Chemira, which we've been discussing now for the last 10 days, a week and a half of Daf Yomi. The Mishnah that we saw yesterday on Kuf Nun Vav Amud Aleph brought in a conflicting viewpoint, an opposing viewpoint, which is that there is no such thing as Matnas Chemira, and if you want to assign your assets to other people, you have to do it with a formal kinyan. You have to do it the way the kinyanim are normally done. If it's movables, you need Mashicha. If it's real estate, if it's property, so you need either Kesef Shtar VeChazaka. And if you want to do a kinyan agav, you may do so as well. But in other words, it has to be done with a formal kinyan. And then the Mishnah brought in a story, an anecdote, and the story seems to support this position. What was the anecdote? So Amrulo. So if you look at the very top Mishnah, very top of the Amud on Kuf Nun Vav Amud Beis. So Amrulo Ma'isa Be'Iman Shel Bnei Rocha. So the following episode is recounted. And it is regarding the mother of Bnei Rochel. She is the mother of the sons of Rochel. Her name was Rochel. Sha'isa Chola, she was sick. The Amra, and she said, Tenu Kivinasi Leviti. And she wanted to give. She had an article of clothing. It was very expensive. And she wanted to give it to her daughter, so she assigned it to her daughter. Vihi Bishnai Masar Mane. Now, it was worth a lot of money. 12 manes. It's 1,200 zuzim. Umesa, and then she died. Vikimu Sivareha. And so she said it. There was no kinyan, and it worked. So the Chachamim say to Rebbe Lazar of our Mishnah, so you see, there's such a thing as Matnas Chemira. Because here we have an episode where she instructed, and the rabbis followed her instructions. Matnas Chemira. To which Amar Lehen, there was an interesting response by Rebbe Lazar, and that is, I'm going to read the Mishnah, B'nei Rochel Tikbara Mimam. It would have been good had mom buried the sons. I know it's very straightforward. Would have been good had mom buried the sons. Meaning the sons are really bad people, and in that situation, in any way, not any opportunity that the chachamim could have taken estate away from the sons and afforded it to the girls. So there, as a punitive fine. So there, the chachamim awarded the daughter this expensive article of clothing. But under normal circumstances, this wouldn't happen. This is what Rebbe Lazar's defense was. Okay, so we got from the Mishnah very little. Meaning, all we got from the Mishnah in defense of Rebbe Lazar is that, the sons were bad people. And therefore, that was a special situation. It was a limited scenario in terms of why it is that the Chachamim awarded the daughter this expensive article of clothing. So, we don't have any more details. What's wrong with the sons? What did they do? I mean, maybe it's not our business, but the Gemara is going to clarify that issue, and that's exactly where we're picking it up right now. We're on Kuf Nun Vav Amud Beis. We are halfway down in the Amud, at the two dots. Amalem b'nei Rochel tik b'ram imam. Mom should have buried the sons. And the Gemara goes on, Ma'itama kalayit lehu. So why were they so cursed? Meaning, obviously, the Gemara is telling us this because there's something we can learn from this in terms of halacha. Am Rav Yehuda Mashmol mekai mekotz and bekerem hayu. So you know what they did? So they planted kalayim. So we know that the Torah prohibits us to take different seeds and plant them in the same field together. And what they did is they had a vineyard, a kerem, and they planted thorns in that field. Now, just as a general note, the issur of kalayim is only when you're planting edible foods in the same field. thorns are generally speaking not edible. However, as we're going to see in just a moment, there is a Mishnah in Kalayim that cites an opinion that says that if it's thorns that are edible by animals, that is going to be a violation of Kalayim in the event that they are planted in a vineyard. And so the Gemara is now telling us that, according to Rebbe Lazar, and parenthetically, it's the same Rebbe Lazar of our Mishnah, so according to Rebbe Lazar, there is a prohibition of planting kotzim, thorns, together with a vineyard. That is a violation of Kelai HaKerem, that's cross planting. And therefore, Rebbe Lazar says, that's what these sons were constantly in violation of, and that's why he cursed them. So the Gemara says, "Kotzim bekerem hayu v'Rebbe Elazar l'tame." Now we have a slight girsa issue in our Gemara. We have Rebbe Eliezer in our Mishnah. It's presented as Rebbe Elazar. Okay, let's for our purposes, let's assume that the girsas are that the name is the same as Rebbe Elazar without the yud. The Nana Mekayim.
Mm-hmm. Is the Rabbanan.
What's that?
This Kalayim Isser is the
Rabbanan. The Kalayim Isser, maybe. Okay.
Thorns are edible by animals, not human.
What's that?
Thorns are edible by animals, not human.
So, again, there's an opinion, which we're going to see right now, that even though it's only edible by animals, it's still going to be an Isser Kalayim. So, whether it's an Isser Daraisa or the Rabbanan, I'm not sure. Okay. So amikaim kotz and bekerem. So if you sustain, allow, plant, right, encourage. If you are planting the thorns amongst the vineyard, Rebbe Elazar Omer kidesh. So Rebbe Elazar says kidesh. Now you're familiar with kalayim, so you know that the term that the Mishnah uses really follows the Torah's terminology. Kidesh literally means sanctified. It sounds like it's a good thing. It's not a good thing. Kidesh in this context means you have now made kalayim, and therefore it needs to be destroyed. The Chachamim Omerim lo kidesh, and the Chachamim are of the opinion that it's not mikudash. It's not literally the word means sanctified, but in this context, it means it's not kalayim. So ela devar shekamo mekayimim. Unless it's something which people normally sustain, meaning something which is normally edible. So bishlam akarkum chazi. So the Gemara says, now if it's something like saffron, I understand. But ela kotzim lamai chazi. The Gemara says, but if we're talking about thorns, like what are we doing with thorns? So I'm a Rabbi Chanina, my time in the Rabbi Lazar. Shekain bar Rabia. So if you go to the various locations, the Gemara here points to Arabia. So mekaimim kotzim besados ligmalehem. So why do they grow thorns? They grow thorns because it's good fodder for the camels. That's what they do in Arabia. So basically, it is food. Admittedly, it's only animal food, but it's still food. And therefore, Rebbe Elazar says that you're in violation of Kalai HaKerem when you're planting thorns and vineyard together in the same field. Okay, so that is a little more details in regards to why Rebbe Elazar cursed the sons of Rochel. Amar Rebbe Levi Konen Kinyan Mishchimera Afil B'Shabbes V'lo Lachush L'Divrei Rebbe Eliezer Elo Shemetitarf Dato Olav. So Rebbe Levi says that we do a Kinyan from Mishchimera even if it's on Shabbos. Meaning we'll allow the Shemira to make an assignment of his estate and his assets, even if we're on Shabbos. Now, on Shabbos, generally speaking, we know the prohibition is that you're not allowed to make kinyanim on Shabbos. But part of the Shemira institution is that because we're worried about the psychological condition and the delicate condition that he's in, so therefore we allow him to make kinyanim. And, as we are going to see in the next Mishnah, but the Gemara kind of like previews the next Mishnah, and even if it were Shabbos, because of this frail state of this person who is in demise, so therefore we allowed him to make a kinyan even on Shabbos. And lo lachush l'divrei Rebbe Elazar, and let's not worry about the opinion of Rebbe Elazar, meaning of our Mishnah, who does not subscribe to matna shchemira, el shem atitar of dato olav. Meaning, again, we're worried that in his frail condition, if we were to prohibit him from assigning his assets to other people, so then he's going to even further decline, and so therefore, to give him some sort of comfort, and, you know, a little bit of encouragement. So therefore, we give him that Shchimera right, even on Shabbos. Which brings us really to the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah now is going to be kind of like a middle position. So far now, in the Gemara we've seen up until now, that for the majority of the last week and a half of Daf Yomi, so we saw that there is an institution called Matnas Shchemira, which means that a person can assign his estates over to other people, even without making a formal kinyan. Then we saw the Mishnah from yesterday's Daf, which we just finished the sugya, and that is the opinion of Rebbe Lazar of the previous Mishnah, who says that there is no such thing as Matnas Shchemira, and if you want to make a kinyan, you have to do it in a formal kinyan, even if the person is dying. And now this Mishnah over here is going to kind of give us a middle position. Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Now again, seems like the correct use of our Mishnah is Rabbi Eliezer, meaning as opposed to the previous Mishnah, which was Rabbi Elazar. That's the easiest way to present it. That's how I'm going to present it this morning. Rabbi Eliezer Omer b'Shabbos v'Arav Kayamim. Mimnei she'in yachol lichtov avalo b'chol. So an interesting middle position by Rabbi Eliezer, and that's the following. That we'll give him this special dispensation of Matnas Shchemira, but only on Shabbos, not during the week. And for a very simple reason. Because on Shabbos, you're not allowed to write things down. And you're not allowed in general to make kinyanim on Shabbos. So therefore, because this person is in such a delicate state and condition, and because we do not want him to have tirif hadas, so therefore the Chachamim gave him a special dispensation, but only on Shabbos, because you can't do a formal kinyan on Shabbos. But once we turn to the week, and once a weekday, so then you can make kinyanim, you could write things down, and therefore the special dispensation of Matnas Shchemira is not afforded to the person who's dying during the week. That is the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Shabbos, Amr Kavach, Amr Bechol. And Rabbi Yoshua says, no, that a Matnas Shchemira is a special dispensation given to him on Shabbos, and how much more so during the week as well. It's a Kavach Amr. It is a biological extension if it applies to Shabbos, if for sure applies during the week. Now let's go over, what is this logical extension? Meaning, what's the Kav HaChomer? What's the argument of the Kav HaChomer? So the Rashbam explains, it goes basically like this. Look, on Shabbos, can you write things down on Shabbos? No. Can you make kinyanim on Shabbos? Generally speaking, no. There are times when you're allowed to make kinyanim on Shabbos, if it's for Shabbos itself, if it's a matana. I can't say it absolutely. It's not that there's no such thing as a kinyan on Shabbos, but generally speaking, you can't make kinyanim on Shabbos. So on Shabbos you can't write, on Shabbos you can't make kinyanim, generally. And yet, you have the Matnas Shchemira. You have the special dispensation, which if somebody's dying, he can create a kinyan, even by verbal designation. If that's true on Shabbos where kinyanim are not allowed, how much more so during the week when kinyanim are allowed? Meaning during the week where you have an opportunity to make a kinyan, so for sure Matnas Shchemira would apply. That's the Kal V'Chomer argument. It is, the Rashbam compares this to the principle of that kol aroy labila im bila ma'akevispo, which means that if, let's say, I bring a mincha offering to the Beis HaMikdash, so we know that the largest kli in the Beis HaMikdash can only hold 60 measures of flour. And there is no kli in the Beis HaMikdash, there's no vessel in the Beis HaMikdash that can hold more than 60. And we know that if I were to try to put in 61, 62, so it will not mix together with the oil. It's too much flour for the amount of oil that goes in. So therefore, in the Beis HaMikdash, so it needs to be a blend of flour and oil. Do I actually need to mix the flour and oil together? No. The answer is no. As long as there's potential for the flour and oil to distribute evenly, so that's going to be enough. This is the principle of kol haroi labila. As long as I could blend it together, ain bila ma'akevis bo. I don't actually have to blend it. So the Rashbam says it's the same idea over here. Meaning during the week, I could make a kinyan. So if during the week, if on Shabbos I can make a kinyan and yet Matnas Shchemira applies, so during the week where I could make a kinyan, so for sure, as long as the potential is there to make a kinyan, so for sure the idea of Matnas Shchemira applies during the week as well. That's the argument. Kayotze bo. And the Mishnah says, and I'll tell you what, we're going to use the same exact argument to deal with another issue as well. Zachon l'kadam and zachon l'gadol. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. I can acquire something on behalf of a minor, but I cannot acquire something on behalf of an adult. Now, this is the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. It's not an accepted halachic viewpoint. I mean, we know the general principle is zachen la'adam shelo b'fanav. I can create a zechus for somebody else as long as it's only to his benefit, not to his detriment. But Rabbi Eliezer in our Mishnah has the following position, which is no. Zechia only works for a minor, but not for an adult. What's the argument over here? The argument is, look, a minor in general can't acquire for himself, but the Chachamim allowed me to acquire on behalf of the minor. When it comes to a gadol, when it comes to an adult, so he can acquire for himself, therefore, I can't acquire for him because he can do it himself. He should do it for himself, and I can't do it for him.
Okay,
no, I understand that Rabbi Eliezer does not subscribe to this idea. That's. I understand that Rabbi Eliezer simply doesn't hold of that. He doesn't hold of that concept. And Rabbi Yoshua, and Rabbi Yoshua says, no, just the opposite. Meaning, yes, you can do a zechiah for katan, and if you can do a zechiah for katan, you for sure can do a zechiah for a gadol. It's a kavachomer. And again, what's a kavachomer? Same exact kavachomer that we just went over previously, which is the idea that by a katan who in general cannot acquire things on his own, I can be zocher for the katan. A gadol who could acquire for his own, so I for sure can do a zechiah for him. Again, it's based on this principle of kol haroi labila. Since he has the opportunity to do zechiah, I for sure can do it for him. That's the opinion of Rabbi Yoshua. There's a discussion, an interesting discussion. You can look at the bottom Tosfos over here. He touches on this issue, and that is why can't I what would be the reservation, the hesitation of doing zechiah for a minor? Meaning, if I'm acquiring on behalf of a minor, why should that be a problem? Why should that even be consideration? So it really touches on a very basic principle, and that is, how does zechiah work? Meaning, what is the mechanics behind zechiah? If I'm acquiring something on behalf of somebody, is that because I'm a shliach? Is that because I'm an agent? Now, we know when it comes to shliach, because when it comes to agency, a katan cannot appoint a shliach. And so if zechiah is really a subcategory of shlichus, and then we obviously have a problem over here. Then I can't do zechiah for a katan because a katan can't appoint a shliach, an agent. See the Baal Tosfos over here. He touches on this issue. It's basically a fundamental question of how does zechiah work. Okay, we're in the meantime. We're going to go to the Gemara. We're going to move ahead. The Gemara now is going to present the following. Again, just to recap in our Mishnah, there are two opinions in the Mishnah regarding matnas shchemira. Rabbi Eliezer, the Mishnah says that matnas shchemira is only for tim on Shabbos, but not during the week. Rabbi Yoshua in the Mishnah says that matnas shchemira applies during on Shabbos, and so much more so during the week as well. And now the Gemara is going to provide for us the following. This is now one of those layered machloksim, which means that you have a machlokus of the later Tanayim in terms of what the opinions are of the earlier Tanayim. Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, they are earlier Tanayim. Rebbe Meir, Rebbe Yehuda, they are last generation Tanayim, right? Rebbe Meir himself was a student of Rebbe Akiva. Rebbe Akiva already lived after Churban Bayis Sheni. So now we're talking about the next generation of Talmidei Chachamim after Rabbi Akiva. So this is really the last generation of Tanaim. And they're going to have now a debate, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, in terms of what was the opinion of the earlier Tanaim. Not the first time we've had this. The Gemara has this a number of times. So Masisa Mani Rabbi Yehuda Hi. So when our Mishnah is recording the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, whose version? Rabbi Yehuda's version. D'tanya. The Gemara now quotes the Braisa, and in this Braisa we're going to see both versions of the Machlokes, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. So, Rabbi Meir Omer, so this is now Rabbi Meir's version of the Machlokes. Rabbi Eliezer Omer Bechol Dvarav Kayamim Nemeshiach Lichtov Avalo B'Shabbos. So here in his version, in Rabbi Yehuda's version, very interesting. Rabbi Eliezer says, Matnas Shchemira is limited. But not the way we have in our Mishnah, but actually the mirror opposite. You can do matnas shchemira during the week, but not on Shabbos. Now, what's the idea behind that? Pretty straightforward. Meaning, during the week where I can make kinyanim, so therefore the Chachamim afforded a shchemira to have the special dispensation of matnas shchemira. But on Shabbos where I can't make kinyanim, so therefore they were not afforded this matnas shchemira opportunity. That is...
But there's no kinyan.
Of course there's a kinyan. Meaning, the kinyan...
The whole Chachamim automatic.
Right, I understand that, right. But it's automatic because the Chachamim, you know, the Chachamim pushed the Kenyan through even without a formal Kenyan. In other words, his verbal designation is enough. His verbal designation is creating the Kenyan. Okay, so that is the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, as reported to us by Rabbi Yehuda. And Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Cholam, Rabbi Kavacham, Shabbos. And Rabbi Yeshua says, if it can occur during the week, and occur during Shabbos. So he uses the Kavachomer. But if you're following carefully, the Kavachomer over here is used in the opposite direction. Meaning, if it applies to the week, for sure it's going to apply on Shabbos. What is that Kavachomer based on? So it's based on the following. Look, the whole reason why there's this institution of Manash Chimera is to provide some sort of comfort for somebody who is in very rapid demise. And during the week, so we are giving him this special dispensation. You can just make verbal designation, and that's it. And your assets are going to go to somebody. If we're going to do that for him during the week, where any way he could make a Kenyan, we're for sure going to do it on Shabbos. Because consider, on Shabbos, you're generally speaking not allowed to make a Kenyan. So now he goes into Shabbos, and now he's gripped with this fear of, oh no, Shabbos is coming. I don't know if I'm going to make it through Shabbos. And now I'm worried about my assets being assigned to the people that I want them assigned to. And if he's not going to have the ability to do so on Shabbos, it's going to give him further tier of hadas. It's going to give him psychological discomfort, and it may mean that his demise will come earlier. So if we're going to make the dispensation during the week, we're for sure going to do it on Shabbos. Okay, Kayotzebo, and now in this version, meaning in Rabbi Yehuda's version of the debate, we're going to do the same thing now regarding Zechiah. Zach l'gadol means Zach l'katan divrei Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Eliezer says you could do Zechiah for a gadol, but you can't do it for a katan. Again, it's a mirror image of what we saw back in the Mishnah. Again, this is Rabbi Yehuda's version. And Rabbi Yeshua Amr Begadol Amr Kavacham Lakatan. You could do Zechiah for Gadol, and if you could do Zechiah for Gadol, you could for sure do it for a Katan. And again, this Kavachomer is the exact opposite of what we saw back in the Mishnah. And the idea of this Kavachomer is, if I could do Zechiah for somebody who can do it himself, I for sure can do it for somebody who can't do it for themselves, and therefore need somebody to quote unquote sponsor them. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, that was all Rabbi Meir's version of the Mishnah. A couple times I said Rabbi Yehuda. Okay, so just edit my sentences, meaning that was all Rabbi Meir's version of the Mishnah. Now we turn to Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Elazar Omer, B'Shabbos Varav Kayamim, Meneshu Yachol Lichtov, Avala B'chol, Rabbi Yeshua Omer, B'Shabbos Amr Kavachomer B'chol. So here I'm just going to read it because it's the same thing that we learned in the Mishnah, meaning that's the exact point. Our Mishnah is presenting Rabbi Yehuda's version of the debate, not Rabbi Meir. Kayotzi Bo Zachon L'Katan, Ben Zachon L'Gadol, Div Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua Omer L'Katan, Amr Kavachomer L'Gadol. Okay, so that is exactly what we saw in our Mishnah. That is Rabbi Yehuda's version. It is a point of interest that generally speaking, when we have Stam Mishnayos, when we have a generic Mishnah, so Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who is recording the Mishnayos, by the way, let's not get confused. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is not Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda, when we see just the words Rabbi Yehuda, it's Rabbi Yehuda Eli. He was a contemporary of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is only one generation, he's the next generation. So so when Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is recording a Mishnayos, so generally speaking, we say Stam Mishnah correct. Rabbi Meir, that generically the Mishnayos, when written in a generic sense, in a generic state, is following generally the viewpoint of Rabbi Meir. And it is interesting over here that there is a Machlokas, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua, and then there's a subsequent debate amongst Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda in terms of how that Machlokas actually goes down. And it's interesting that our Mishnah is adopting Rabbi Yehuda's viewpoint of the Machlokas, not Rabbi Meir's viewpoint of the Machlokas. Okay, just a point of interest. Okay, we start the next Mishnah. Okay, Nafal Abayis Alav Al Aviv O Alav Al Marishav. So unfortunately, the Mishnah gives the following scenario: the house caves in, and the house caves in on a father and a son, and we're focusing really on the son. Meaning, so let's give the son a name. Let's call him Reuven. Father will be Yaakov. And so the house falls on the two of them. Now at this point in time, Reuven's got himself no properties, no assets, meaning Reuven's really poor. And he's married, or he's got outstanding loans. And so now, when the house comes in on the two of them, which died first? Which of the two died first? Now, obviously, we don't know. But it's really important to clarify that detail in terms of which died first. Because let's consider. If, let's say, Yaakov dies first, so that means that his estate now goes to Reuven. Now Reuven then dies. Okay, but that means that, for a short period of time, Reuven had assets. He had properties that were inherited to him. So in that moment of time now that he had those assets, so they're all going to be now encumbered for his obligations. So that means now that his widow can collect those estate, can collect from the estate. That means that his and any of his balechov, any of his creditors can come collect from the estate. But let's reverse the order of death. Let's say first Reuven dies and then Yaakov dies. So that means that Reuven died penniless. He didn't have any assets. He didn't have any properties. So if Reuven died first and then Yaakov died, so then who now gets all those assets? Who gets the estates? Who gets the property? So it's going to be Reuven's children. Reuven's children are not inheriting it from Reuven because Reuven died first. Reuven's children are going to be inheriting it directly from the grandfather. Remember, we discussed this back in the 8th parak in terms of line of succession. Line of succession is such that if the father's, if let's talk from the perspective of the grandchildren. If their father's not alive but they have a grandfather, they're going to be inheriting it directly from the grandfather. So the so therefore the estate is going to go directly to the grandchildren and not go through Reuven. And that means that for all of Reuven's creditors, including his widow, so they're not going to be able to collect from the estate because there was no encumbrance placed on the estate. Okay, so it's really important to ascertain in terms of who died first. Was it Yaakov or was it Reuven? But the simple problem is, of course, is that we don't know, and most likely we'll never know. So now, in terms of a question of who's got the better argument to collect the estate. So basically now you have two people who make a claim to the estate. The widow's claim is going to be, look, I'll make an argument. Of course, it's not verifiable. It's what's called in halacha a tainas shema. She doesn't know this to be so, but it's plausible that first Yaakov died, then Reuven died, and therefore I have a shibud on the estate. I have an encumbrance on the estate, and therefore I'm able to collect my ksuva from the property. And the children are going to say, no. What's also just as equally plausible is that first our father died, then our grandfather died, and therefore you, the widow, have no encumbrance on the estate, and therefore the entire estate goes to us. Okay? That's the dilemma of the Mishnah. I'm going to read it now inside. The Mishnah says, Nafal abayis alav al avivo alav al morishav. The house falls down on him, on the father, or him, on some other benefactor. Okay, it doesn't really matter. Meaning, and for our purposes, let's just stick with the case of the father. Makes it easy. And the son in the house, meaning Reuven. So he's got a wife with a ksuva obligation. He's got other creditors. So now, the Reuven's children make the following argument. First, our father died. Then our grandfather died. And the creditors and the widows say, no, we're going to make the following argument. That first Yaakov died, then Reuven died. Now, so that means that for a short period of time, Reuven had the property and on his possession, which means that now an encumbrance has been created on that property, and therefore we are entitled to that property. So Beishamai says each argument has weight, equal weight, and therefore the money is to be divided. Beisil's position is we go with Chazaka. We go with who is current holder. Current holder is the one who is going to be awarded the property.
Even if they die simultaneously.
Now, let's assume for our purposes that simultaneous death is a near impossibility. It's also another option. But the Gemara elsewhere, not here, the Gemara elsewhere talks about Efshalat Samtsim, Efshalat Samtsim, right? Is it possible that they precisely died at the same moment? Let's keep it at two options, even though I'm acknowledging that there may be a third option.
You think current holder, the fact about Yaakov is basically having property or whatever. Nobody's holding it at that point when he dies.
No, holding doesn't mean physically holding. Holding just simply means that the current owner. So we know that. Right. Right. Correct.
So what's going to be there?
So what's going to be is that without any mitigating circumstances, it goes to the Yorshim. It goes to those who stand to inherit him, which in this case are going to be the grandchildren. Okay. So so Basil's position obviously is really easy to explain. Chazakah. It is one of the most important and basic guiding principles regarding ownership of any property. If I'm a holder, so if I'm mochzak, so therefore I'm entitled to keep it. And if there is any challenge, if the challenge does not come with verifiable proof, I don't have to give you the property. And so Basil's position is extraordinarily easy to understand and to defend. Beis Shammai. Beis Shammai's position is really hard to defend because the creditors and the widow are saying, here's a plausible scenario. It's just plausible. It doesn't mean that that happened. And how can Beis Shammai say that under these circumstances, each of the competing arguments are of equal weight? It's really hard to say that. Meaning that the grandchildren are for sure in a position to inherit. The widow and the creditors may get it, but only if they're right with their suggestion that first Yaakov died and then Reuven died. It's just a possibility. It's not a definitive position. Yeah, right. I was thinking that as well. So the Rashbam explains Beis Shammai as follows and defends Beis Shammai in the following manner. We have a principle which is not agreed to by everybody, but the principle of kol ha ome legavos kegavoi dami, which means as follows, that if I have an outstanding obligation that's owed to me, kol ha ome legavos, as long as it's a collectible, will view it as if I already collected it. Okay. Generally speaking, that kind of idea is assigned to Rabbi Shimon elsewhere throughout Shas. But the Rashbam says that's Beit Shammai over here. Beit Shammai over here subscribes to that principle of anything which stands to be collected is considered as if it's already collected. That means now that in terms of who is a holder of this property. So if we subscribe to this principle of Kol HaOmed, the creditor and the widow are just as much holders of the property as the grandchildren, because there is an obligation headed in their direction. The widow has a ksuva obligation, the creditors have just a standard note, and since it is collectible, it's viewed, says Beit Shammai, as if it's already been collected, and therefore their hold is just as strong as that of the grandchildren of Yaakov. That is the Rashbam's defense of Beit Shammai, an explanation of Beit Shammai. Okay, we start with the Gemara Tanan Hasam. Hamavis Chaver B'Shtar Govim Nechasim Meshubadim. Ayideidim Godim Nechasim B'Necharim. Okay, so we start with the Mishnah. The Mishnah here presents to us the most basic of information, which we already know, and that is that if I lend somebody money and it is a documented loan, so then Govim Nechasim Meshubadim. So now that documented loan creates a lien against the loan, which means that I have a lien on this property, and that even if he were to sell off that property, I can go to the sellers and I can say, look, sorry, it's very unfortunate for you. Truth of the matter is buyer beware, meaning you should have done your research. But I have a lien on that property, therefore I'm going to collect the property. Now, as far as you're concerned, you're going to go back to the seller, right? My borrower, and you're going to try to have to figure out a way to get some sort of reimbursement for the property. Okay, again, we all know this. In other words, it's very simple. Documented loans create a lien on the property. However, if it's ayidei edim, if it's an undocumented loan, even though there were witnesses who were there to view the loan, so you, the creditor, can only come and collect assets that he has on hand. Any assets that he sold, there is no lien on those assets, on the property that he sold, and therefore, if it's an undocumented loan, so you can't come and collect from properties that are already sold off. Okay, this is basic, this is information we already knew, we've gone over this time and again throughout Shas. Here comes the question of the day, and this will take up the rest of our day today. Bai Shmuel, di'ikni v'kana mahu. So Shmuel now asks the following question. And that is, let's say that we write up a document, right? In other words, it's going to be a documented loan. I'm going to lend you money and we're going to write up the document. And in the document, we write the following. not only is there going to be a lien on all of my current estate holdings, but there's also going to be a lien on any future estates that I buy from this point going forward. Valid or not valid? David, just as a point of curiosity. Okay, well, we're headed in that direction. David, and nowadays, is a lien, can a lien be created on a future purchase?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's a very interesting question.
Okay, I mean, that's the Gemara's question. What, in America?
It doesn't exist. Yeah. I mean, the purchase doesn't exist yet.
Right. Right.
It all depends on what you're writing in the document.
Right. Well,
wait a second. Yes, you could have a lien because if you put it on, but it wouldn't be on real property. It would be like if you had an accounts receivable inventory.
Right.
Then you could have on future property.
On futures, okay. Okay, so that's what we're discussing right now. And take a look at the Rashbam. This is Shmuel's question. By Shmuel, Hakos of a chaver mishaben and nilach bechol v'chal kol nechasim she'ekne mahu. V'hainu shekos from b'shtaros dekana v'dayit v'asid ani lemikne. And you even write this in the document, meaning we're not just assuming that this is so, but you even write this in the document. So in the document, basically, this is like the borrower's way of trying to give further assurances to the lender. Look. Not only am I going to pay you back, and not only are my current estate holdings going to be mortgaged against the loan, but even my future, meaning anything I buy from this point going forward, is also going to be encumbered against the loan. So does that work, yes or no? Now, the Gemara says like this, and Ben already predicted where the Gemara is headed with this direction. You know, Ben's been around for a while. So, oh, we'll get to that. Well, very good. Very good. You're right. That's the right question. We're going to get to that. So, So if you subscribe to Ramir's viewpoint, which Ramir says that you can make a kinyan on something which has not yet come into fruition. So let's say I want to buy next year's crop. According to Ramir, it's a valid purchase. Even though the crop hasn't arrived yet, I can buy in next year's crop. In other words, Reb Meir subscribes to this idea that a person is makna a davar shelo bal olam. So if you subscribe to Reb Meir's viewpoint, then for sure this works. Now, I'd like to amplify that point. For sure this works. What does that mean, for sure this works? Mm-hmm. I'm going to read the Rashbam. Aliba de Reb Meir, gabe ha omer lisha harei ha-mekudesh l'sech ha-shiyamus yishech. So the Rashbam over here gives other classic examples of davar shelo bal olam. So let's say I go over to a woman and say, look, I'm currently married right now. But, you're currently married right now, right? That's a better example because I, in principle, can marry more than one wife. Not interested, but that's neither here nor there. But but if I go to a woman who's currently married and said, look, I know you're married right now, and obviously I can't be mekadesh you right now, but I'm going to give you the kesef kedusha now, and so that in the event that you become available later on, you know, your husband dies, whatever. Or you get a divorce. So in the event that you get available later on, so the kesef kedusha I give you now should become effective when it's possible. A classic example of a davar shelo bal olam. Right, not yet available, but putting it down now for a time later where it becomes available.
It may not be available. This one it may
okay.
not
ever
become.
Okay, agreed. But in other words, if she does become available later point in time, does it work? Yes or no? Reb Meir says yes, it does. So loti ba'alach devade kana dekaven de peres dekel da'adain lo ba'la olam kana kol shekein de mishtabir le karkaos de asa la alma elisha adain lo kanam lova bishah sheshibed. So the Rashbam explains like this. It's beautiful. Meaning, look, we're not buying next year's harvest. So we're talking about fruit that are not even in the world right now. They're not here. And Reb Meir subscribes to the idea that I could still make a kinyan even though it's not yet in the world. Here, we're talking about a shibud. What we're talking about is a lien. What's the holdback right now? The holdback is the property's here, it's just that you don't own it. But it's in the world. And it just happens to be that sometime subsequent to the origination of the loan, I'm going to buy property. So it's even better, meaning if Reb Meir allows for the idea of making an acquisition on something that's not even in the world, he for sure is going to subscribe to this idea over here where there will be a shibud on something where it's in the world, just simply currently not owned by the borrower. Okay, very good. So that is the so according to Reb Meir, the Gemara says, I don't even, nothing even to discuss, for sure would be good. But that's all according to the Shita of Rav Meir. But what about according to the Chachamim? Alibed Rav Meir Damar Damakna Davishal Balalam Ti Baylach Devadekana Elakiti Baylach Alibed Rabbanan. But according to the Chachamim now, what an excellent question. Is there, can there be a shibud on a subsequent purchase made by the borrower? So Eina Damakna Davishal Balalam. So they normally subscribe to this idea that you can't make a acquisition on a future. Over here, a shibud. Would it be okay? Would it be acceptable? And again, as we just got through the Rashbam, meaning, and one can make the argument that even according to the Chachamim, there could still be a distinction made between the classic Davar Shel Bal Olam, like next year's harvest, versus a shibud. Okay. So, Amar Rav Yosef Tashma. So the Gemara says, well, let's consider the following. This is a, what we're about to quote is a Mishnah in Ksuvos. We saw this Mishnah some time ago, and let's remind each other what this Mishnah in Ksuvos taught us. Okay. Let's say that today is the 27th?
Yeah.
Okay. Today's the 28th. Okay, right? Okay. So today's the 28th, June 28th. So let's say that, that Danny, I borrow for money from you today, June 28th. Okay, so Danny, you'll be the lender, I'll be the borrower. And now, at a later point in time, so you sell me a property. Let's say July 28th, a month from now. So you sell me a property. Okay. And so now I make the following argument. You take me to court and you say, look, you go to the judge and say, look, Sugarman's a nice guy, but I have an outstanding loan against him and he hasn't paid me yet. And I then go to the judge, we're like 2 months now from today, and I say to the judge, I say, look, you know, I'll tell you what, I know Danny's holding a note against me. I understand that, and it puts me in a very compromised position. But I'm going to make the following argument in my defense. You know, he then sold me a property. He sold me a property, and he took my money for the sale of the property. So let me ask you a question. If I, in fact, owed him money, like he's claiming, so why in the world would he then take my money when he sold me the property? Meaning, isn't it fair to argue that what should happen is if I owe him the money, so then would he be taking money from me for the sale of a property? In other words,
you're saying you should have collected his loan first,
right? In other words, the first thing he should have done is collected the loan, and not taken money from me for a property. So in other words, so my defense is going to be: look, why would he sell me a property if in fact I actually owe him money? Okay, so that is my argument. Is that a good argument, or is that not a good argument? The Mishnah Ksuvos brings down a debate between Admon and the Chachamim. Admon is of the opinion that that is an excellent argument. And in fact, it's such a good argument, that is an admissible argument to now say that I in fact don't owe him the money on the loan. And the Chachamim say, no, it's not a good argument. It's not a good argument. And they're two separate events, and more than that, says the Chachamim, not only is it two separate events, but really, Danny's really smart. Because what has Danny accomplished now in the sale of the property? What he has now done is now, prior to the sale of the property, I had no property. Which means now that he has money that I owe him, and how is he going to collect? God only knows. Good luck, Danny. So, but now that he sold me a property, and somehow I managed to collect money in order to buy the property, so now I have assets. And now, on his loan, so now he's going to come to me at a later point in time and say, okay, look, Sugarman, I've been very patient with you. But now that you defaulted on the loan, and it's been a long time now, I'm going to collect the property from you. So the Chachamim's position is, not only is it not a good argument, but in fact, Danny's position is a better position because he put himself in a position now as a creditor where he can come and now collect property from me. Wow. Okay. And let's read this together inside. That's the Chachamim's position. Chachamim Amarim Zeh Yapikeach. This man's a smart man. Shemach Halos HaKarkim Mishu Yachol HaMashkan Olav. Because now that Danny sold me property, so now he stands to gain from that sale in that now he can collect on the loan. So I'm so fine. So now, obviously, when did I buy the property? Well after the origination of the loan. I mean, the loan occurred on June 28th, and the sale of the property occurred on July 28th. So now, is there an encumbrance on a property that occurs post-loan, post-origination of the loan? Seemingly, the answer is obviously yes. Otherwise, what kind of discussion are we having? So Amalei Rav Aminei Kamar. So Rav says, you want to bring a proof from there? Don't bring a proof from there. It's not the right place to bring a proof. Because look, what are we talking about over here? We're talking about Dani collecting a loan with assets that I'm currently holding. Assets that I'm currently holding, it could be something that I bought at a later point in time. It could be the jacket off the back of my, off literally my back. Any current holding that I have is going to be meshubad, mortgaged against the money that I owe him. So that's not our discussion. What Shmuel's question is as follows. I bought a property post origination of the loan, and then I sold it. That's the question of Shmuel. So the Mishnah Ksuvos, although it is good, but it's not good enough to answer our question. Because our question is, I bought a property after the loan, and then I subsequently sold it. Is there now going to be a lien on that property following that property? That's the question. Ki kami bailan, digne kano machar, digne kano vahorish, mai. So the Gemara says that's the question, and so therefore we have not yet answered our question. Amar Rav Chana Tashma, and now, Hedy, this is where the point where you wanted, and that is why we're having this discussion now, because of our Mishnah. So let's now recap our Mishnah. Our Mishnah talks about the case where the house collapses on Yaakov and on Reuven. Who died first, we don't know. And in the event that the order of death was first Yaakov, then Reuven, that means that for a short period of time, Reuven now had assets. And therefore, the creditors can go after Reuven and after the assets that Reuven had. Now, Reuven obviously is not holding onto the assets because Reuven died. So, Yaakov died first. Again, it's as a possibility. Yaakov died first, then Reuven dies, and then the grandchildren get it. But because Reuven had it for the smallest interim of time, so now the creditors can go after that property. Oh. So now we see that if a borrower has property, even though it's at a later point in time, and even though it's passed on to somebody else, there is a lien attached to it, and therefore the creditors can go after it. Right? That is a good proof. And the Gemara tries to make this argument. I'm reading quickly because it's the Mishnah. So the Gemara says, even if we were to say that first Yaakov dies and Reuven dies, but Reuven got this only after the origination of the loan. And how then can the Mishnah make the argument, and therefore the creditors can get it? It must therefore be that even though you acquire this after the origination of the loan, and even though you pass it on afterwards, there's a lien that attaches to it. It seems to be a really compelling argument. So Amalu Rav Nachman Ziri Chavran Tigrama. So Rav Nachman says, you know, they tried this argument in the Beis Medrash, and the Ziri together with his colleagues said as follows. No. Really, there is no lien that attaches to this property. And if there's no lien that attaches to this property, so what is a creditor's argument? Creditor's argument is mitzvah al hayasomim lefroach chavas avihem. Generally speaking, if dad dies with account payables, so as kind of like kibud avaim, so you should pay off dad's account payables. Now, there's no shibud, which the Gemara is about to point out in just a second, but still, as kind of like a mitzvah's kibud avaim, the Gemara doesn't use that language. I'm using that language, but I think it's a good way to look at it. As kind of like kibud avaim, so you should pay off your father's outstanding obligations. Huh? Estate money, and if there's no estate money, then... Yeah. So from Maskevla Ravashi Milvapehu. So now Ravashi says, look, that's all well and good, but it's not enough. Don't put this under the category of a documented loan. Meaning, yes, the children do have some sort of moral, ethical obligation to do so, but don't put this under the category of a documented loan. This is not a documented note. It's a milva alpeh. And undocumented loans are not to be collected neither from Yershim, neither from Lekuchos, neither from those who inherited and those nor from those who bought the property. So the Gemara basically is saying, look, there may be some moral or ethical obligation, but certainly it doesn't fall under the category of a documented loan, and therefore it is not, it can't be collected. So the Gemara says, so who is the author of this position? Meaning, our Mishnah that talks about a lien attaching to a property that was only acquired at a later point in time, and even though it was then further passed on to the next generation, the lien attaches itself to it, and it seems to resolve Shmuel's question. The Gemara says it could very well be that the Mishnah subscribes to the viewpoint of Reb Meir. Meaning, as we have already established, Reb Meir says that Adam Makna Davishal Balaolam, certainly a Sheba can attach to a property even though the property was acquired at a later point in time. And our Mishnah could just simply be subscribing to the viewpoint of Reb Meir. So even though we have our Mishnah, and even though the Mishnah seems to be a very good proof, it could very well be that our Mishnah subscribes to Reb Meir. So from our Mishnah, we don't have a rock solid proof to the question of Shmuel. Okay, we're going to pause over here. Tomorrow we'll finish up this discussion. Short daf tomorrow. We'll catch up tomorrow. So again, just a quick recap: a discussion today of Matna Shchimira. Is there an institution of Matna Shchimira? So as the yesterday's daf and today's daf, some are of the opinion that there's no such institution. That's the opinion of Rebbe Elazar. Rabbi Eliezer strikes some sort of compromise position. Yes, Matna Shchimira, but only on Shabbos, not during the week. And Rabbi Yeshua's position, which is really the mission that we saw back on Kuf Memvav, is that no, there's always a Matna Shchimira opportunity, both during the week and on Shabbos as well. The basic idea of Matna Shchimira is Shemati Tarif Daito. We don't want him to have a accelerated demise because of the stress and anguish of not being able to assign his estate. Therefore, we allow him to do so both during the week and on Shabbos as well. And the next Mishnah, we talked about the house collapsing on the father and on the son. The son has got a widow. The son has got creditors. Do they have a right to the property with the suggestion or plausible suggestion that perhaps they're going to, that the order of death was first father, then the son? So Rebbe Hillel's position is no. In other words, it's only a possibility. We don't know that to be so. Meanwhile, the Yorshim are Muchzakim. They're the ones who are currently holding the property. So Amotzi Mechaver, Olav Araya. And so therefore, no. Beit Shammai says the money is to be divided. And then the Gemara's discussion was, can there be a lien attached to a property that is purchased at a future point in time? That is that's the big question of the day. Our Mishnah seems to prove the position, although the Gemara deflected by simply saying that our Mishnah follows the opinion of Rebbe Meir.